Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hi, Paul.
Hello, Chirag. I'm speaking with Chirag Baines. I'm so happy you could take my call. Thank you so much for being part of the Quarantine Tapes. Tell me, Chirag, what have you been up to for the last 7 months of this pandemic?
Paul, thanks for having me on the Quarantine Tapes. Well, like most Americans and many people around the world, I've been staying inside my house, but it has been extremely hectic. I've been fighting voting rights battles around the country. I work at Demos, which is a think tank that uses a variety of strategies, including litigation, to fight to make democracy real and really build an inclusive democracy. And that means protecting the right to vote for Black and Brown voters. And we've had lawsuits around the country, especially focused on making sure that barriers to the vote come down at this time of increased intensity with the pandemic. And it has been a whirlwind.
Where does my call find you? Where are you located?
I live in Washington, D.C. So you're getting me in my home in D.C. It's a somewhat chaotic environment. There are a couple of kids who are distance learning. My spouse is an attorney as well in civil rights. This is where the magic happens, at least during the coronavirus pandemic.
And when you say you work for Demos, can you give our listeners a little bit of a sense what that is? I know at Demos you're the director of legal strategies. Perhaps very briefly you can contextualize what that job in fact is.
Yeah, absolutely. Demos is a think tank that works for a truly just and inclusive democracy. And we think about that both in terms of traditional democracy issues like voting and campaign finance or money and politics issues. And we also think of it in terms of a truly just economy, one that works for everyone regardless of their race. And we put racial justice at the center of all of our work. We are focused on building an America that works for Black people, Brown people, and all Americans. And as the director of legal strategies, I lead our legal team. We bring litigation, we bring lawsuits over voting rights to fight voter suppression and attack structural barriers that make it hard for people to register to vote and to vote. We also work on big, kind of over the horizon, game-changing policy changes, legislation, and putting ideas out into the ecosystem to show what an affirmative vision of a democracy that really worked for everyone, where everyone counts, where everyone can have their say, would look like. So my day-to-day is overseeing a variety of lawsuits, writing and editing briefs, working with coalition partners, especially state-based partners. We work with a variety of movement organizations that are representing individuals across the country, especially from communities of color, to advocate for policies where everyone can vote and there's less of an impact from big money in our political system.
So Chirag, let's go backwards. Let's go back to 2013 and the Supreme Court case you know well, Shelby versus Holder. What do you think the consequences have been of that ruling?
Well, the consequences of Shelby County versus Holder were enormous and have been continuing for our democracy, very harmful. That was a case where the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, took on and carved out the most important part of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That statute was the result of the civil rights movement. Many people put their lives on the line. People died for that statute to become law, and it prohibited discrimination in voting practices. And it had a rather ingenious provision that required that jurisdictions, states and sub-jurisdictions of state, put any changes that they wanted to make to their voting laws before a federal court or the U.S. Department of Justice for review before they could put those changes into place. And those jurisdictions were jurisdictions that had a history of discrimination against Black people in voting. And that stopped a lot of voter suppression from happening before it started. In 2013, in the Shelby County case, the Supreme Court said that the formula that decided which jurisdictions were covered was outdated and that it didn't reflect, quote, current conditions, even though Congress had reauthorized the law several times and as late as 2006, almost unanimously, with thousands and thousands of pages in the congressional record showing that it was still needed. And so what it did is it freed states from having to get approval for their changes before putting them into effect and allowed them to immediately pursue voter suppression. And that is what happened. Previously covered jurisdictions immediately started changing their laws. In the hours after the court's decision, Texas and North Carolina advanced restrictions on voting that the courts later found to be discriminatory. Organizations had to bring lawsuits, and the Justice Department did as well, on the back end after these laws were passed, talking about strict voter ID and a bunch of other provisions that made it hard to vote. And the courts found them to be discriminatory. And the North Carolina decision, that ruling, that there was a ruling in the North Carolina case that actually stated that the law that was passed after Shelby County was surgically targeting black voters in the state. So those are just a couple of examples. Yeah. We've seen massive voter purges in states that were previously covered, people being kicked off the rolls. We've seen polling places being closed. It has become harder to vote in many states because we don't have the protections of the Voting Rights Act.
Let's go even further backwards. Not that 2013 is really backwards by a lot, but you've written about Barry Goldwater and Operation Eagle Eye in 1964. To what extent does that history relate to what we're witnessing today?
Eagle Eye was an operation, it was a scheme really that was launched by candidate Barry Goldwater in 1964. The point of it was to remove people from the voting rolls and to intimidate them at the polls, targeting communities of color, on the assumption that voters of color would vote for Democrats. And the scheme involved sending people out to watch the polls. You know, they had poll watchers who were sent out to target 35 cities in particular. Mm. And, you know, there's a public record of the program director saying he expected to stop 1.25 million people from voting through this program. And that was kind of an early phase of what we then saw repeatedly over the ensuing years. Most famously, the Republican National Committee ran what they called a ballot security operation in 1981 in New Jersey, where they tried to remove people from the polls and actually hired off-duty police officers to patrol the polls in black and Latino neighborhoods in New Jersey, trying to scare people away. And what do we have now? Fast forward to 2020, we have the President of the United States telling his supporters to go and watch voters, telling the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by. It's just, you know, we are in the middle of voting right now. Early voting is happening in several states. We're starting to get reports of folks standing near polling places and intimidating voters. We are very worried that there could be activity like that, including by armed groups. So it's something we're paying attention to right now and preparing to fight off.
Chirag, you've described voter fraud as a pretext for voter suppression. How so? And what, in fact, do you mean by that? And what is the role of dark money in these efforts?
Right. Well, voter fraud is something we're hearing a lot about these days. And it's actually an old hobby horse for those who want to suppress the vote. This Operation Eagle Eye that I just discussed was justified by concerns about so-called voter fraud. Now, all of the evidence that we have indicates that that kind of fraud is extremely rare. There are studies showing you're more likely to get hit by lightning than to see in-person voter fraud, you know, happening at the polls. So I could cite a lot of studies showing that it's rare, but perversely, it has the impact of people coming away thinking more about voter fraud. And that is exactly what people who talk about it want, because voter fraud is the fear that it creates is a justification for voter suppression. Barriers to the vote like strict photographic identification, stringent voter registration rules, the closing of polling places, the opposition to vote by mail, which we desperately need during a pandemic when many people cannot leave their homes safely. So it is used to, despite the lack of evidence that it is an actual problem of any substantial nature, it is used to suppress the vote, particularly of black and brown voters. So that's what I mean when I write about that. I think we're seeing that every day in America today as there's essentially a fight on over the right to vote. You would imagine that in a democracy, everyone would agree that all eligible voters should be able to vote. Mm-hmm. And yet every election, we have tens of millions of people who cannot vote, many of them because of these kinds of voter suppression barriers.
Indeed, one would imagine that. It's quite extraordinary to me just how much this moment, this pandemic, has brought into focus all kinds of issues that, in a way, we nearly suppressed from our consciousness.
I think that's spot on. I mean, it's the part of this is about the pandemic, and part of it, we're talking about long-standing problems. And I am as depressing as it can be to think about voter suppression and deliberate attempts to keep people from the polls. It's also a moment to imagine what our democracy could look like if we really styled it in a way where everyone could participate.
Chirac, and help me. Let's imagine. Have a dream.
Yeah, we're dreaming on this topic, Paul, about what our democracy could look like?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think my dream is that we think about the right to vote and to participate in this democracy as a core part of personhood, of membership in this community that we call United States of America. And that rather than looking for ways to exclude people and carve them out of the franchise, which we have done time and time again in our history, that we look to include people and understand that everyone needs to have a voice for the system to have legitimacy and for our elected officials to be accountable to all of us. And so that would mean looking at, you know, practices that we might take for granted today and questioning whether they should in fact exist. To give one example, I think about the issue of felony disenfranchisement, that is taking the right to vote away from people because they have had a felony conviction at some point in their lives. A report came out today showing that 5.2 million eligible voters cannot vote, otherwise eligible voters cannot vote because they have a felony conviction. And that is disproportionately black and Latino people who fall into that category. And that, to me, there's no justification for it. In fact, those rules across the states are based in a racist history. There were deliberate attempts, well documented, that to strip political power from black people. That is the origin of these felony disenfranchisement laws. And today they're justified as, well, if you've committed a crime, you have no business being involved in what the laws should be going forward. But I don't see it that way. I think, no, actually, these are members of the community as well. The vast majority of people will be returning to society. We need to bring down these artificial walls that deny people's humanity and dignity, and have a constitutional scheme that is made more legitimate because it engages everyone, even those who we have decided have crossed moral lines in our society at one point or another. Now, there are lots of other arguments for why felony disenfranchisement is intolerable. You know, the criminal justice system is shot through with racial bias, for one. But for me, it's this starting point that actually everyone needs to count, and the right to vote is a core part of personhood that is a compelling argument alongside those of racial justice.
So, I mean, what you're saying is that we're discriminating against a certain part of the population twice.
I think that's right. Yes, when it comes to felony disenfranchisement, absolutely. You know, you look at people of color, black people in particular, are more likely to be arrested, to be stopped, searched, arrested, prosecuted. They have longer sentences. They get worse plea deals. And this is for the same crimes. And that's a result of bias in prosecutorial judgment and policing. And I say that as a former prosecutor. I was a prosecutor for the federal government.
I know. I read your piece about Philando Castile.
Yes, right. A tragic case and a man just going about his business who was shot and killed by a police officer, with his girlfriend and her 4-year-old daughter in the back seat. Horrendous. And then the public was unable to secure a conviction there. And that's just, one window into how unjust our criminal legal system is. And, you know, I saw it directly by being involved in it. And, you know, that is an area we absolutely have to reform. How do we do that? How do we bring about change? It's got to be that we have a truly democratic system so people can exercise power through the channels that exist. That power is being cut off. We can't emphasize this enough. We're in the middle of a fight over the right to vote, over who counts in the census. And it's, we need to take an approach that is as expansive as possible if we want to have true democratic legitimacy in this country.
How do we get there? Do we have a kind of a truth and reconciliation attempt?
I'd love to see that, Paul. I would love to see true, open, and honest conversations in this country. You know, Brian Stevenson of Equal Justice Initiative has called for that for years, where we are honest about the history of this country from its origins and the role that slavery played and the continuing discrimination. And I would love to see that. I also think there's an opportunity right now to pursue bold democracy reform, really truly transformative reforms. That depends what happens with this election in terms of who's the president and what the Congress looks like. But there is a bill in Congress right now, for example, it's called H.R. 1, the For the People Act, that passed the House in this Congress and in the next Congress could become law. It would vastly expand voter registration, outlaw voter purges, make redistricting fairer, prohibit racial discrimination and voter suppression, and reduce the influence of big money in politics. That's a big democracy package, the kind of thing that we can achieve now to really transform what this country looks like and make it more equitable all around.
Despite what's happening with the Supreme Court nomination?
The Supreme Court would be a major barrier. There's no sugarcoating that. The Supreme Court has ruled against voting rights over and over. They have ruled against equitable census policies that happened just recently. That is something that would have to be taken on directly. We should be talking about court reform. We have a Supreme Court. You know, if this nominee goes through, that would be 6-3 conservative majority, a rather extreme conservative majority. That is out of touch policy-wise with where everyday Americans are. But worse than that, the current Supreme Court, you know, even before this nomination, is breaking down the democratic process and making it harder for majorities to translate their numbers into policy. I'm thinking here about what we talked about earlier, the Shelby County decision, right? That was an attempt by Congress to protect voters of color from discrimination, and the Supreme Court declared it to be unconstitutional. The Supreme Court also washed its hands of partisan gerrymandering and said that it can't weigh in on cases where one party rigs the rules by drawing lines in a way that make many, in some cases, the majority of votes not count, not able to translate into majority power in Congress or in state legislatures. There are many examples like this where the Supreme Court is not protecting the political process, which should be its role, but actually making it easier for a minority to entrench its rule. That is a structural problem that calls for structural reform on the court.
Chirag, you worked under the Obama administration. You worked for the Department of Justice. Can you describe your experience on issues of police reform in Ferguson and elsewhere?
Yes, I worked in the Civil Rights Division, first as a prosecutor of police crimes and then on more systemic and structural roots of police misconduct. You know, as a prosecutor, I was looking at individual misconduct. So, you know, I prosecuted, for example, a case of a law enforcement officer who raped a woman while taking her to jail after an arrest. I prosecuted a case of, you know, two police officers who were literally committing highway robbery. They would sit out on the highway, look for drivers that they thought were Latino or Latina and who they thought could be undocumented, and they would stop them and steal their money. I also, you know, prosecuted a number of cases like this, and it was important to pursue justice for the victims in those cases and to hold police officers accountable, but it was very much in the frame of individual bad actors. And what I came to see is that, you know, we actually have systemic problems in law enforcement. We have systemic bias, and we need to look at that in a systemic way. And the Ferguson case was a good example of engaging in that kind of enforcement work. you know, federal law actually provides the Justice Department the ability to investigate and sue a whole police department if there's a pattern or practice of misconduct. And that's what we found in Ferguson. And we were able to tell the story of systemic police abuse that was well understood in the communities of color in that city, in that town, that were subjected to it, but that had gone unchallenged. And in Ferguson, they were using their court system like a cash register, basically, to extract money through burdensome fines and fees and, you know, through the criminal process on almost entirely black residents in the city. And the police force was out there issuing tickets, making arrests, using excessive force in the service of this kind of revenue-generating role that the court system was playing. And we were able to validate what people in the community had been saying for generations, actually, in Ferguson, that this is happening and it's unlawful. And the approach under the Obama administration was to use all the tools at our disposal to bring about change. And we would sue jurisdictions and enter consent decrees, which were detailed agreements whereby they agreed to make structural changes to their hiring, to their use of force policies, to their training, to their accountability mechanisms, to change how those departments run and to make them more accountable to the people that they serve. That's work I'm very proud to have engaged in. It's also work that has suffered under this administration, so it's going to have to be a priority if there's a new administration next year.
I'm going to read to you a quotation from John Stewart on the murder of George Floyd, and I'd like you to react, so bear with me for a moment. This is a cycle, and I feel that in some ways the issue is that we're addressing the wrong problem. We continue to make this about police, the how of it. But the how isn't as important as the why, which we never address. The police are a reflection of a society. They're not a rogue alien organization that came down to torment the black community. They're enforcing segregation. Segregation is legally over, but it never ended. The police are, in some respects, a border patrol, and they patrol the border between the two Americas. We have that so that the rest of us don't have to deal with it. To what extent do you, Chirag, agree with John Stewart's analysis?
That's very powerful. Yeah, that's very powerful. And you know, what resonates with me is he's not saying there's not a problem with the police, but he's saying it's much bigger than that. It's much more systemic. And there's actually a debate about whether racial bias is systemic in America. I find that surprising because I've seen it in my work in every sphere, you know, in my democracy work, in my criminal justice work. And yet we have the current vice president of America, Mike Pence, who was on TV the other day questioning whether there was any such thing as systemic racism. So, you know, I think we absolutely have to tackle every institution to include the police. The police carry the ability to use deadly force. They can take life with the imprimatur of law. And so it's serious. They can disturb people's lives, and they often do in everyday ways that many of us don't see, but that can completely destroy trust and also destroy in our system, in our legal system, but also, you know, really wreck people's lives. If you're constantly stopped by the police because you're black or brown or because you're poor. And that is the reality for many people in America. So I think we do have to tackle every institution. So we do need to scrutinize the police. We do need to change the way that policing works and think about public safety differently. You know, invest in true sources of public safety, like education, like housing, like jobs, like healthcare. And then we also need to think more broadly about racial justice and racial equity. That's actually a big part of the reason that I went to my current organization, DEMOS. You know, I love the work that I did at the Justice Department. I'm glad to have been a part of the police accountability work. But it wasn't just about police. It was about a democracy that is not working for black and brown people and many other marginalized groups, right? But that actually, like by design, had racial inequity and racism baked into it, and that we have been trying to purge of that taint ever since the founding. So for me, it really resonates. And it tells me that I need to stay focused on these core democracy issues to ensure that everybody counts, everyone can have a say in this country, so that we can build a country that where our government, our representatives look like us, they reflect our priorities, and where, you know, everyone can live a truly full and thriving life.
You've spoken about the need to aggressively pursue an agenda of full democratic participation. And we've spoken about this a little bit. What might this agenda entail? And why don't we hear it championed, for instance, by Joe Biden?
I think an aggressive agenda for full participation would be legislation in Congress and in the states that tries to bring down all barriers to the vote and tries to mitigate and really, you know, stamp out the corrupting influence of big money in politics. So it should be that any eligible voter, you know, any person who is eligible to vote, who wants to vote, can cast their ballot. To make that a reality, we need, you know, quite specific policies that, you know, folks at Demos and other organizations have been working on for a while. Automatic voter registration, same day voter registration, a ban on purges, you know, fair districting. We need to put forward that kind of bold agenda. Joe Biden's actually in favor of that set of policies. So that gives me a lot of hope that, you know, we can actually accomplish this. I think we actually need to think even bigger than that structural reform. Those are structural reforms, but we need to go beyond that. And looking at how our constitutional design works, we've got an electoral college that prevents a majority of American people from translating their power into their candidate of choice. You know, Donald Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. That problem is only going to get worse as there are more people living in what are currently blue states and fewer in red states. And that has racial equity consequences. I don't mean this only as a partisan thing. You know, we've got a Senate that has the same kind of inequality baked into it. So, and we have lack of representation for areas. I live in D.C. We've got 710,000 residents in D.C. And we have no representation in Congress, no voting representation in Congress. You know, Wyoming has roughly the same number of people, and they have two senators and a congressperson. There are several other states with population around there that, you know, have an incredible amount of power. And when you look at the places that don't have voting power in Congress, you know, D.C., Puerto Rico, the other territories, they are overwhelmingly people of color. And when you look at the places that have disproportionate voting power in Congress and power in the Electoral College, they're disproportionately white. So I see a racial equity need to take on this constitutional design of our system and make it more equitable. And, you know, I actually think that this is a conversation that there's a lot of appetite for. People are seeing how our democracy is not working, and democracy reform is on you know, the lips of everyday people in the way that it hasn't been before. So I have a lot of hope that we actually can make some progress on these fronts.
Going from hope to something you wrote yesterday, you said that we are like the frog in the boiling pot of water. So how close are we to the boiling point?
Yeah, well, you're getting a sense of how I can sway between despair and hope. It's mostly hope, but,
you're, you're not alone.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I think we're experiencing some dark times right now. I remain hopeful because I believe in the power of everyday people to transform this country. But it's undeniable. You know, I wrote that yesterday because we suffered a number of defeats in the courts of appeals in voting rights cases, you know, and at the Supreme Court in one 24-hour period. The courts of appeals are allowing states like Ohio and Texas to make it hard to return your mail ballot by limiting the number of drop boxes you have. States where courts have said that states should give people more time to cast their ballots, the appellate courts are reversing that. Notary and witness requirements, you have to get your ballot notarized, you know, and during a pandemic, those are being upheld by the courts of appeals. And then the U.S. Supreme Court just allowed the census to stop counting people early. The census count will end tomorrow. That early end will disproportionately undercount communities of color, which has massive consequences for representation, you know, when they draw the district lines, and also for the distribution of federal resources, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So that was the source of my low moment yesterday. I think if we don't change track, we are going to be boiling very quickly. You know, we are seeing an attack on the right to vote. As I mentioned earlier, courts are making it harder to use the judicial system to protect the political process and protect individual voters. And we have a Congress that disproportionately does not represent the people, you know, because of the structural inequality built in. to the Senate and the Electoral College by extension, which affects who becomes president. So I very much worry that these changes, I think that there are policies that are being put in place right now that are meant to entrench minority rule and to enhance the voting power of white voters and to limit the power of black and brown voters. There's actually a smoking gun document from recently deceased Republican operative who was kind of the lead person. His name was Thomas Hoffler, in charge of GOP redistricting. And it showed that the purpose of redistricting was to try to limit the voting power of voters of color and enhance the power of Republicans and, quote, non-Hispanic whites. So it's in black and white. We have the documents. We know that this has been the purpose. And that is what will happen. This is a critical year. We're in the year of the census. The redistricting happens once every 10 years, the drawing of the lines of, you know, who you get to vote for as a citizen in this country. And there's an opportunity to really entrench power for that shrinking minority, or there's an opportunity for the people to speak loudly and boldly and reclaim their democracy by electing candidates who want to make it easier to vote and who want to draw fair district lines and who want to restructure our democracy so it works going forward. I am hopeful that we'll see the latter and that there'll be a glorious future, a much more equitable future for this country.
Chirag Bains, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Please continue to fight.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate your time, and you can bet I will.
Thank you so much. Take good care of yourself.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.